The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0. Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
Show. I'm your host, Sam Sorbo, here on Mojo50.com in our new time at 10 a.m. Weekdays. So thank you for joining us here. If you missed the show and you want to catch it in the podcast, my podcasts are hosted by Salem Media over at Mike Gallagher's site, MikeOnline.com. MikeOnline.com. And so thanks for tuning in today. We're going to talk today in a little bit about everything that's been going on, obviously, with the coronavirus. Herd immunity, if you haven't heard that term before, you will learn more about it. Also, homeschooling making an enormous thrust into the community today, because even our elected officials are now advocating for home education. But before I get into all of that, I want to talk to you about a story out of prisons that might, give you a little bit more hope in humanity these days. This story came across my desk a while ago, and I've been trying to get this guest on for a little while. He's a very busy man, for reasons that will become obvious. He's the founder and chairman of Capital Three, which is an impact investment company. They have investments in the U.S., Central America, and he also takes part in enterprise stewardship, which equips marketplace leaders with resources to transform their personal life and business enterprises. And so without further ado, Pete Oakes, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Sam. Great to be with you.
Yeah. And you have a voice for radio, too. I mean, you've hit the trifecta or whatever they call that in sports that I don't do.
You're way too kind.
All right. So I want to talk to you about this prison program, and I want to play something from a video that I saw that just came. I was doing some research on something, and I saw this video, and I was just so impressed with the idea behind this video that I thought I should have this guy on the program, because what you've managed to do in prisons is amazing. So this is just part of the video. Take a listen to this.
It's an unusual bunch of guys or inmates that we have working for us at the prison. They've committed the worst crimes known to society.
I ended up being an accomplice to taking someone's life.
I took someone's life who didn't deserve to be taken.
I have a life sentence.
The jury convicted me of second degree murder intentional. So I got 13 years, and I've done 6 of it so far.
So that's just a taste of some of the individuals that you're in the business of helping. And, you know, this is sort of a forgotten population. Let's start with you, though. You're married over 35 years. You're an entrepreneur. You had an upbringing on farms, basically. Went from commercial banker to investment banker to business owner. And you discovered that financial success, and tremendous financial success, right? You achieved your dream, and somehow that didn't quite satisfy you. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So Sam, at the age of 40, I woke up and realized I'd been financially successful, but I wasn't very satisfied. And it really happened very quickly. Over the next couple of months, I just really began to I really began to do some deep introspection, and with the help of a couple of older mentors who had already mentored me for probably 15 years at this point in time, I came to the understanding of ownership versus stewardship. And when I understood that I didn't own anything and I was just the manager, it rocked my world. And that has launched me over the last 25 years on a journey of really understanding that I believe the purpose of business is not to maximize shareholder value, which is what 98% of the world will tell you is the purpose of business. But I believe the purpose of business is to really be a, what we would call a catalyst for flourishing. And we would define flourishing as having enough sufficient material provision, deep authentic relationships, and a purpose for living. Those three things.
That's actually so counter the socialism message that I see in the community at large, interestingly. And I wasn't actually thinking of going there, but was it in a sense a midlife crisis? Do you think that a lot of people reach they reach 40-ish, right? Midlife, and they go, oh my gosh, so wait, so this is it?
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I think there are three big questions in life that we have to answer. The first one comes at the age of 20, or these are realizations, really. And early 20s, we, you know, probably a couple of months before we graduate college, we say, oh my word, I have to get a job. The second thing that happens to us at the age of 40 is, oh, I've got this job, and it really hasn't panned out and given me the meaning that I thought. So I think that's kind of the second crisis. The third one happens when you get in your 60s, and I'm going through this right now, and that is, oh, my land, I'm going to die.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, I think those three things, particularly at 40, you start to figure out the meaning of life, and in your 60s, I think you're really searching for what's really eternally significant.
And if you don't figure out the meaning of life in your 40s, in your 60s, you get really sad.
Oh, absolutely.
So interesting, because in my 20s, I had achieved great financial success. And I said, wow, is this what it's all about? Like just this? Like stick a fork in me, I'm done now? And
right.
And that led me to a belief in God, strangely. Maybe not strangely. So, you get the material and then you go, but wait, what about the spiritual, which seems to be sort of what happened to you in your 40s. You're like, okay, I've arrived, but there's got to be more to it than this. And that brought you to sort of a spiritual realization. You talk in the video about generosity being sort of a family tradition. Tell me about that. And then talk to me about where we are in our culture today. Are we teaching generosity? Is it something that can be taught and learned?
Yes. Yeah, so I was fortunate to grow up on a farm, and I was born and raised in a Christian home. And my parents, I didn't really understand this, but they really demonstrated generosity in amazing ways. A quick story. I was 8 or 9. I was out in the shop playing. I went over to the corner, pulled back a blanket that was laying in the corner, and there was a brand new big radio flyer wagon with a box of apples in it. And this was a few days before Christmas, and I knew exactly what I was getting for Christmas, and I was absolutely excited because my wagon was beat up and broken down and whatever. Christmas Eve rolled around. My dad said, Pete, I want you to help me. We went out. We went into the shop. He picked up the wagon, put it in the car. I was beginning to feel fairly broken down at this point in time. We drove to the other side of town, went to a poor family's house, and there were 5 or 6 kids in there. We rolled that wagon up with the box of apples, and of course I was heartbroken. But when we went in that house and I saw the joy on these young people's face, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And that was the start of, I think, my lesson on generosity. And so, yes, I think in America, you know, we are so bent on living for ourselves instead of living for something greater than ourselves. And generosity, during the 90s, when I had made this switch from ownership to stewardship, unfortunately, I mistook financial generosity with stewardship. And in 2001, when 9/11 hit, our businesses, I almost went bankrupt. And I was literally mad at God. And I said, don't you understand what I've done for you? Because we were very generous through the 90s. And he really, the message that came back to me was, Pete, I really don't want your money. I want you. And I think stewardship is much more than just financial generosity. It's the giving of our time, talent, and treasure. And in these times with this whole coronavirus thing, I think my prayer is that this plague, as it were, will turn the hearts of the American people.
I join you in that. In fact, I'm a homeschool advocate, so I've been putting out videos and encouragement to parents that perhaps this is an opportunity for them to embrace something that they've been eschewing because of fear or whatever for too long, because I do see it as a way for families. I know families are coming together. They're having game night again because there's nowhere else to
exactly.
go, right? So I want to talk about that, but let's stay to, because I want to get back to this stewardship idea. You mentioned that life is an acrostic. What do you mean by that?
Yes, so we use the term life, L-I-F-E. L stands for labor. I stands for influence. F stands for financial resources, and E stands for expertise. I think those four attributes that all of us have to some measure or another encompass all that we have in life. Our labor was really time. Our influence is really about our tribe, the people that we can influence. Our financial resources are about treasure, and our expertise is really about our talent. So I like to talk about stewarding our life, living a life of impact. And if we look at those four attributes, I think it covers the waterfront, as it were, right. as to things that we have that we can steward.
Right. And so at some point you said, I need to start a business in a prison.
Well, actually, Sam, this was after 9/11, and we had come, you know, our businesses had come back, and we owned several businesses in a small town, and we couldn't find enough entry-level manufacturing labor to build things for us. So we began the warden of the local, there happened to be a local state-owned prison in that town, and the warden came to me and said, Pete, I have work release inmates where we'll literally put them on a bus, we'll ship them to you during the day, you can work them, and then we'll bring them back to prison at night. We did that. After 2 or 3 months, I said, this is terrific. I went to the warden and I said, I need more of these men. And he said, I don't have any more of them, but if you can figure out how to move your business behind the walls of my prison, and by the way, I have 20,000 square feet of manufacturing space that the prison was using but is now not using, I've got 1,200 men ready to work. And I said, this is perfect. And so within about two or three weeks, we had let it.
Perfect because you've got convicted criminals. You think that it's perfect to hire these very damaged men who are serving time for crimes against society?
Sam, when you're desperate, you will do desperate things. And I was desperate for labor. And so I said, literally, look, these guys, I can take my business inside the prison. They will show up on time. I can work them hard. I can actually help them pay for the, you know, the atrocity that they committed. And I went in purely from a perspective of self-interest because I needed the labor. But I will tell you, within about 90 days, I came to understand maybe the only difference between them and me was that they got caught. And so I'm being a bit facetious there.
Obviously. But because men, as Christians, we know we're all sinners, right?
That's correct.
And so
absolutely.
You go in there and you say, okay, they sinned in that thing that they did. But in other things, they're still God's children. They're still capable individuals.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
As I got to know them personally, I saw that they were, most of them were, you know, they're individuals. They're created by God. They have lots of talents. They just typically in 10 or 15 minutes in a stupid decision made a bad call in life, and they were in prison. And so probably 90 days in, I got this idea that I said, this, I believe God's really called us in here to do something more than just work these men. He's brought us in there to, and at this point in time, we were really working on this whole concept of flourishing. And so when you have a prison, which is a desert of human flourishing, it is, it's a perfect place to try out these concepts and ideas.
So, I'm sure that the audience is really curious at this point. What is the business that you moved into the prison?
Yeah, so we have two different businesses. One builds industrial seating that primarily goes on off-road equipment, lawnmowers, zero-turn lawnmowers, tractors, trenching equipment. And we have another company that builds electrical assemblies, wiring harnesses, control panels. So in 2006, we moved our electrical assemblies company in behind the walls of a maximum security prison. And today we employ about 200 inmates in two different prisons, actually, and we're building industrial seating and electrical assemblies in behind the walls of the prison.
It's just amazing. And so not only are you employing these men, you're giving them job skills so that in the eventuality that they get out of prison, some of them will be getting out of prison. All of them will be getting out of prison?
No, some of them won't.
So some we were actually yeah. Go ahead.
We're in a maximum security prison, so some of them are lifers that right. work for us. But I would say that 80 or 90% of them that work for us will get out. If I go back to the concept of flourishing for just a moment.
Yeah, please.
We really talk about that is economic, social, and spiritual capital. Economic capital being food, clothing, shelter, social being great relationships, and spiritual capital being a purpose for living. And of course, for those of us who are Christians, that's a personal relationship with Jesus. So our business, the purpose of our business is to create, in fact, the name of it, our holding company is called Capital Three. We want to create economic, social, and spiritual capital in business. So what we do economically for the inmates, we give them a job. And by the way, we pay them fair market value wages. Most inmates who work for the state will make 50 cents, maybe a dollar a day. So we pay them $100 a day. We don't actually even set their wage. The state of Kansas will set their wage based on what they do. So when you give a man a job I never understood the power of a paycheck, but they take that money, 25% of that money goes back to the state for room and board. And then the balance of it gets put in, they take some out for restitution, some out for child support. Most of the guys save some. They have a mandatory 10% savings account, and then the balance typically goes back home to help their family. So that's the economic capital piece.
Right, and this is a tremendous service that you're offering this, guys, and it was thoughtful for the warden to suggest it and say, if you can move the business inside the prison, then, this would be a boon to the prison. Has the prison overall benefited? Has the warden mentioned, anything about benefits just within the prison walls for, attitude or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, certainly. So there are really two numbers that people look at in prison. One is what we call recidivism rates. The other is what they call disciplinary reports. So if you have a disciplinary report, in other words, you've gotten in trouble in the last 4 or 5 months in prison for it could be a fight or it could be a disrespectful to a guard. You can't work for us in private enterprise. So what's happened is there are 1,200 men in this prison, and we employ about 200 of them. There are another 1,000 men that are looking for a job, and the only way they will get that job is if they behave. They keep their DRs, disciplinary reports, down. The second thing is recidivism rates. That's the rate that inmates return back to prison, typically during a 5-year stint after they get out. Nationally, that number is 65%. In Kansas, it's 35%. Our number that we've tracked, and we've had 85 men now work for us over the last 5 years that have left and are back in society, only 5 of those have returned. So we're at about a 7% recidivism rate. And when you think that an inmate costs the state $30,000 a year, it is a tremendous benefit to the state of Kansas.
Right. Also, I think part of the reason for the recidivism is that you've got people who have been living, you know, confined for so long, they don't know how to function in the real world anymore. Giving these men a job, teaching them work ethic and earnings, and not only that, when they leave, they have a savings account, they have some money in the bank. Like you're setting them up for success. So
yes,
I'm not surprised that some of them come back into the system, because there are other components to surviving in the real world after you've served time. But certainly you're giving them these guys such a boost to their ability to re-enter public life, or real life, basically.
Yes,
it's just amazing. I'm sure you know today a lot more than you ever thought you would know about prisons.
Well, it's just amazing the story that you played a little bit of, Louis Gutierrez, who was the man in that video. About a year into our prison stint, I got this idea. We need to cast a big vision for these inmates. So every month I do a values talk. So I stand up in front of them and we talk about one of our values in our business. And I just try to encourage them as people. And I cast a vision for them. I said, guys, here is my vision for this prison. I want this to be the best prison in the United States of America. And the way we will have the best prison, if I can help you become the best person you can become. So my promise to you is I will help you do that. The response from that, they literally laughed out loud at first.
Well, yeah.
But after, you know, best prison, isn't that an oxymoron?
Right.
And within about 5 or 6 months, they started to buy into that vision. And I think the greatest thing we give them is a vision for who they can be after they have fallen.
Right.
Hope.
Well, and yes, that is the Christian message, is redemption. So you're
absolutely
offering these individuals a chance at redemption. And it comes in many forms. It's not just you have to go and ask for forgiveness and then you get forgiveness and then you're done. You're offering them the opportunity to pay restitution. You're offering them the opportunity to donate to charities. You're offering them the value that comes with having a job and performing a task and being compensated for it, self-worth, right? You're offering them all of these things with your greedy, greedy capitalism that you brought into the prison.
Yes, exactly.
But you're offering them life lessons. So just describe to me, because you cast this vision, I want the best prison possible, but then you went about, you set about getting it done. So you offer classes.
Yes. So if we go back to our economic, social, spiritual capital, economically, we try to give them a really good job. Socially, the main thing we do is try to get them to understand that relationships are very important. So we offer classes on fathering, on personal finance, on anger management, on leadership. We literally just got approved by the prison. We have about 10,000 hours of online classes that we have in our own personnel computer systems that we use at our work. And those are now available to our inmates. So you can learn lean manufacturing. You can learn how to work an Excel spreadsheet. So all of these things are available to them for training. And of course, most of them don't even have a high school degree. So socially, we try to just get them to be the best they can be. And, become the best they can be in their job and learn that trade well. Spiritually, yep, of course, it's not something we require, but we offer Bible studies. We're actually about to complete $1 million church that we've actually built inside of the prison. There was no place for these men to worship. And so that will be finished up here in the next month or two. And they're really excited about that. It's a 125-year-old prison, and the state of Kansas has given us 7,000 square feet in the top floor of this rotunda kind of a building in the prison to create this church. And so we started a seminary in the prison. We've graduated 7, and we have 23 in our second class. Those men are literally changing the face of the prison with the work that they're doing.
Well, you've heard about the turnaround at Angola Prison, I'm sure.
Yes, Burl Cain's done a terrific job there.
Yeah. So you put a seminary in there and you offer these individuals a glimpse into the hope that comes with redemption. It's just an amazing transformation that you can evoke in someone's life. And it sounds like you're doing that in this prison as well. And you said there's more than one prison. So are you franchising?
Well,
you're franchising your best prison policy to all the prisons.
Sam, we would love to do that. And in fact, we've had numerous governors and senators and people come through the prison to try to encourage them to do this in their states. It's not as simple as it sounds. It was fortuitous that we wound up in the prison. It just happened to be the perfect storm to allow us to get in there. I've looked at, trying to acquire other companies and move them in, but it really has to be an organic growth that you can start something and then grow it inside of the prison, which we've been able to do. But I do believe, particularly with the whole Chinese manufacturing issues, I think there is a huge workforce in America, in prisons, that if we could bring manufacturing back to the states, and particularly entry-level manufacturing, we have a ready-made workforce, and the change that it would create in our society would be phenomenal.
So that's actually fascinating to me. I wanted to ask you this question. It's a delicate question, so forgive me, but I just want to put it out there. There are people out there who would criticize this and say, how dare you take advantage of prisoners for your labor, right?
Yes.
What is the answer to that?
My answer is, anyone that believes that way, I will offer to pay their ticket to Wichita, Kansas, and take them into the prison, and then just let them make that decision for themselves.
I love that.
Basically, and what they will see is they will see inmates flourishing.
Right.
They have a job.
Right.
They understand relationships, and most of them, and they may not be Christians, and that's not something we force on them, but most of them have a purpose for living now.
Right.
And when you give that to people, it's amazing to me. Back to stewardship and generosity for just a moment. One of the things we do with our employees is we have a matching generosity program. So if you give a dollar to somebody, the business matches that. Our inmates outgive our civilian employees by several factors. And I believe it's the reason for that is they are so appreciative of what they have that they want to give back. And so I would just, people that, we get a number of people that are critical, and all I can say is come take a look, and after spending an hour in prison, we'll just turn you loose, and I'll come back in an hour and get you, and then you tell me what you think.
Right. So it's an amazing thing that you've done. Your wife has helped you with it, I know, because it took a big transformation, basically, of your business sense to do this, in a sense, right?
Correct.
It was a new project. I in the video, and the video's up on my official Facebook page for viewers if they want to see. The video's fantastic. It's worth looking at. It's just a short video about this whole thing. Your wife, I think, sort of kicks it off and says, well, we decided to go into the prison. Like, we've never been in a prison before, but this way. I mean, I can't imagine. And these are people who obviously are desperate for outreach. So it's a wonderful thing. I want to end on the coronavirus. Have you seen acts of charity that have come out of the coronavirus situation? Have you witnessed anything that you want to talk about?
Yes. So it's amazing to me, even inside of our own business, we build seats, so we have lots of sewing machines. We sew the covers that go on seats. And we are literally frantically working in the next few days to see if we can begin to sew masks and protective gear that are just unavailable. And we're seeing numerous other businesses reach out and begin to really talk among ourselves as to how can we really make an impact. And it's not even for financial gain. It's really, I think most entrepreneurs who start something don't do it because they want to get rich. They do it because they want to solve a problem and help humanity.
Right.
And we're really seeing that happen. It's amazing.
It's fantastic. Pete Oakes, thank you so much for coming on the program. Is there any website that you want to give people, any place you want to send people?
Yes. So there are two. One would be a website, capital, I, the word capital, CAPITALIII.com.
Okay.
And then there is another website that we'll have up in just literally the next few days called highimpactlife.com. And we have, we've written a book and we have some resources out there that will allow people to understand this whole triple bottom line approach to life.
Great. I love it. Pete Oakes, thank you so much. We'll have you back when you get that up and running and we'll talk about that then. Okay.
Great. Sam, thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Wow. That was great. Okay. So, yeah, I'll put that up on the website and stuff. And, I'm blown away. I think it's just amazing. I did a podcast with Billy Halliwell that has been making the rounds now about home education. And I love the title, so I'm going to share it with you. Actress Sam Sorbo Homeschools and Her Tips Could Save Your Sanity. I just love it. I've done a couple of these live YouTube. I'm doing a live YouTube broadcast every morning this week at 9 a.m. To walk parents through just some of the scarier stuff that comes along with being thrown into a home education paradigm that that you didn't expect. It's unnerving, and I remember how bad it was when I was doing it voluntarily, when I just decided that I was going to home educate. And I was so anxious and so concerned that I, you know, get it right and stuff. And so I've decided to do these videos to help parents sort of navigate and try to assuage some of their anxiety and trepidation, because you don't need to be that that nervous. You're not going to break it, you know. This came through on Twitter. I had to share it.
Because of coronavirus, you are going to be quarantined, but you have a choice.
So it's an individual, and he's just looking at the camera, and he's hearing this voice, and he's like nodding along. Okay, I get it. And he's just waiting, because now the guy's going to give him a choice. Listen.
You, A, quarantine with your wife and child, or B?
B.
B.
Just be. That's it. Sorry, it was just funny. I did a video a couple days ago that I posted about introverts, because my daughter is an introvert. And I got this comment on the YouTube video, which I really appreciated. Being an introvert is a big adventure. If you have loving parents and friends, it can give you a lot. So God help those who think there is something wrong with them. So was I for a very long time. Now it's a gift for me, and thank you for this video. That made me feel good, so thank you for reaching out. I did get some videos on the Fox hit that I had on Saturday morning. Somebody wrote, good job on Fox this morning. I don't have kids, but with your enthusiasm, I wish I did. Good work. So I like that. Let's see. I'm just going through. By the way, I'll just say this. They're not paying me, but I'll tell you. VeritasPress.com is offering, what did he write me? 60 days of access at no cost to do any of their courses. That's at Veritas Press. So there are places available that will help you get the word out. Not get the word out, that will help you do your children a favor and help you explore the ideas, right? So I love this. Caught you on Fox this morning. So correct. Go back to the beginning of the chapter and you can help. Did calculus 20 years after college for my kids. Education is broken. So, all right, let's see. I'm supposed to be getting a call and I'm not getting the call. Oh, I know. Hold on. I'm going to see if I can answer it and switch it right over to my computer. And there it is. Hello.
Good morning.
Well, good morning. Ken LaCourte. Ken LaCourte is the founder of LaCourte News, and their motto is News Unspun, Talk Uncensored. I've known Ken for several years. You might not remember meeting me, Ken. I don't know, but
I do. You came into. I remember seeing you a few times over at the Fox News Channel.
Exactly. So it's great to hear you, and congratulations on the new endeavor at LaCourte News. Because Ken was a senior executive at Fox News for many years, and headed the editorial team at Fox News. We're going to talk today a little bit about California. Oh, my goodness. You guys are on total lockdown, right?
You know, that's what they tell me. It seems to affect everybody's life differently. I'm almost a little disappointed that it kind of hasn't affected my life all that much. I still go into my small office. I don't go out to dinner. You can still go out and take a hike and walk. The people I tell the toughest for out here are, you know, a lot of businesses are closed down, and a lot of people when those businesses are closed aren't making money. So when you go by and you see the local diner and you know that all the workers there are at home not making a dollar, that's the toughest thing that I think is going on right now.
What I find really tough, and so I'm trying to get this word to people, is for them to do this lockdown indefinitely. That word indefinitely is outrageous. How dare they? Right?
You know, it's like everybody seems to be pushing the worst case scenario.
Right.
Here. I mean, Governor Newsom here said it could be 56% of people getting this infection. Governor Cuomo in New York said it would be 80%. You know, and all you can do is just kind of hope that they're going wildly overboard on that. I mean, look, two countries have gotten past this, right? South Korea and China. They're, you know, they had the deaths and infections go up, and then like a bell curve, it turned at a certain point and came back down after 3 weeks or so.
Now, Ken, hold on, because I've been hearing reports that China is overstating their overstating their cure rate or whatever, that they haven't actually turned it around.
You know, look, you don't want to trust anything China says because they like making stuff up. But what we're not getting is scenes that they had of you know, people lined up outside of hospitals. You're seeing that even in Wuhan, that they took down the temporary hospitals, that people aren't running around with masks. So even if they're fudging with those numbers by a factor of three or four, you know, it seems to be, you know, even in China with everybody with a cell phone, we would have seen that if it was still getting worse and worse.
Right.
So, you know, you talk about how long might this go on. I suspect, look, if our numbers still in 3 weeks are still kind of going up exponentially, well, we're all going to sit in our house and just take it. If after a week or two or whatever that is, that curve kind of goes down and you start to see that, okay, we're on top of this and it's going down, I think then everything changes and they have some idea of saying, okay, it's not forever, and here's what it might be.
Well,
so,
yeah.
I think so I just think that's going to be dependent kind of on what reality in the United States, what happens here.
Right. Well, Trump tweeted over the weekend, basically 15-day trial period, and then we're done, basically. Something like, you know, you don't want the cure to be worse than the disease. And if we kill our economy it's not much to live for. Like, why are we saving lives if there's nothing, you know what I mean? Like, so, so my theory was,
on the other hand, if it got out of control and it overwhelmed our medical facilities, like it did in at least three countries.
Yes.
That's going to hurt our economy.
And that's,
I mean, look at Italy. Italy's going to recover from this more slowly than we will.
Right. And that's what I tell people, because there are a lot of people out there who are like, oh, it's just hyped up, it's ridiculous. And I'm like, it's not ridiculous, because if the system gets overwhelmed, then it's really, really bad.
Right.
But they have to figure out, they have to strike that balance. And it bothers me when they have these, I know they have to make the dire case scenario to get people serious enough, you know, to take them seriously. Like, I get that.
Right.
But it's just this indefinitely. They really ought to be saying for the next 2 weeks, also because it will encourage people to behave, because people will behave more if they think, well, it's only for this short period of time. But if you tell them your life is over and you can't go out of your house indefinitely, then people are like, well, screw that. I'm just going to go out. I mean, if I'm going to die anyway, I might as well die happy. You know, that kind of attitude. Tell me about the ban on the five U.S. media outlets in China.
Look, I think that was just the latest tit for tat. I know that we have substantive issues with China, that this president is the first one in our history that actually said, you know what, enough of the way that they're abusing copyright law, the way that they're stealing and having government funded and government organized theft of information, the currency manipulation. So he's been at a I don't want to say war with China, but he's been pushing back harder than they've ever gotten pushed back from a president. And so I think it was within the past month that he said, you know, you've got these Chinese media outlets, which are really a functional arm of the government. And they have hundreds of employees. We're going to treat them like they're a functional arm of the government. And then they kind of retaliated and threw some of the reporters from those outlets out. You shrug your shoulder. It's not good. China, you know, I mean, we have seen, this was a very good example of totalitarian regimes often just, when something goes bad, they just default towards lying and covering up. We saw it at the beginning of this thing until they couldn't anymore. I mean, you know, literally throwing a doctor in jail and making him sign, I'm sorry, I brought everybody's attention to this thing that everybody should have had attention paid to. That's just how regimes work when they have all the power and they become totalitarian.
And right.
We've seen that with China this time.
And now we're seeing the wonders of socialized medicine in the way that Italy has dealt with the virus.
Yeah, Italy, you know, it's like I always thought that they were a little bit more first world. I mean, I know that they're older population. I think there's going to be a lot of figuring out what exactly did they do wrong there.
Maybe the hashtag hug a Chinese was not the best advised program.
I was just to talk about that. literally the mayor of Milan, after the United States, and I think even after top travel to China, was like, whoa, everybody's being racist, being mad, upset with the Chinese people, and then literally like videos of them hugging Chinese people. Probably a little too laissez-faire, probably not the smartest thing in much of it.
When I saw that, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, it's just, and the thing is, it's like, don't allow the facts to trump your feelings, right?
I mean, like, look, early on in this, and I still think that this has been, I think that at the end of the day, we will say, this was still largely overblown too. We will look back and say, interesting that in 2009, H1N1 killed X amount of people in this. And you sound kind of cold-hearted talking about, wow, several thousand people is nothing. But, you know, 7,500 people die every day in America. It's just a big place. There's 300 million people. So, you know, even over a month of us talking about this thing, there will be a 250,000 Americans who've passed away since we've started lockdown and whatnot over any given month here. So it's like, you can look at numbers, and if it's like, oh my goodness, 5,000 people died, that's horrific. You know, you kind of have to look at it in context, especially as you're taking down your economic structure too. Those are things you have to think hard about.
In fact, I want to ask you this because we'll be in hindsight pretty soon. Okay. And what numbers do you think Italy would have to post in order to justify the incredible reaction that we've had in the United States with the lockdowns and everything? What numbers do you think Italy would have to post for that to have been justified? Because there's got to be, you know, there's if the cure is worse than the disease and all of that. And so I'm wondering how we could quantify it so that we know that it was either.
Well, you know, we also have to keep in mind that. Yeah. And we also have to keep in mind, you know, these are smaller countries, or at least some of them are. I mean, Italy is like a seventh of our size. So, I mean, certainly if we were anywhere on Italy, we'd be having, you know, 20, 50,000 people die here. You know, I suspect when all this is flushed out in a year, you take a look and say, what was the economic hit and how many lives did it claim? And were those people, you know, and you hate to be too cold-hearted, but somebody who's got emphysema and lung cancer in the last 3 months of his life, he died by coronavirus. Okay, it's not good, but it's not like, oh my gosh, you took somebody out of the prime of their lives. So you've got that factor in there too. You know, I suspect everything at the governmental level, big, has to say, what is the cost of this in true human life? And if we made every highway in America the maximum speed limit of 25 miles an hour, we would save thousands of lives every year. But we've decided that our time and is worth. Well, I mean, but you have to have to run those numbers. It's like,
well, that's
put money into breast cancer.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Or into cars.
But so yeah. Italy has it's gone overblown in Italy. They had their prisons taxed. We won't get the figures from China. We won't know, right? But at least from Italy, right, we can see the Italians failed to act in a timely fashion, and so it reached. Or it will have when it's completed its run, it will have reached its climax. What number of deaths? Because look, 80,000 people died last year of influenza or whatever, right?
Right.
So what number of deaths in Italy would justify our huge reaction in the United States? That's what
I think there should be a number, like
a million deaths in Italy. You know, if it hits a million.
Right now you would look at.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think anytime you have like stretchers out of the front of a hospital, you're like, okay, this is really bad, and stop going to work and doing all that. They've had about 5,500 people die there now, and they're still on the upslope of this thing. So there's
right.
going to be thousands more. So when you translate that into a country the size of the United States, that's, you know, 40,000, 50,000. And will that be higher, lower? Or certainly will be lower. How much higher will that be?
Right.
You know, those are all tricky questions. So,
well, no, I mean,
Italy's also the worst.
Because the thing is,
that's what we're looking at.
But at this point, there's no more comparison because we responded faster. And we responded, and it's a tiered approach, right? We didn't respond with everything right away. So in theory, we will have gotten a handle on it. I'm certainly hopeful that we won't see that many deaths. So we'll see. I guess we'll just have to play it out. If Italy continues to climb, and they are completely overwhelmed, so they will continue to climb. I find it, you know, people are arguing against the reaction by saying there have only been 4,000 deaths worldwide. So why are we overreacting? You're completely missing the point when you say that. That's like saying, hey, you've flown in an airplane. Here's a parachute. Try this, because it's the same difference. It's a completely different thing. You can't just take a snapshot of this virus today and compare it to H1N1 that happened years ago and say we're overreacting,
yeah,
right?
But I do think we did react in a radically different way in this one.
Oh, for sure.
And I don't know if that is true. The media getting more hyperactive. Certainly some of that was part of, I mean, you know, I saw some of the media just salivating that this could be the way to hurt Trump. I mean,
absolutely.
Literally the New York Times, before there was one death in the United States, New York Times, one of the columnists, you know, it's time to call it the Trump virus. I mean, you know, so that was part of it there. So, you know, you look at all of those things. On the other hand, this has happened worldwide, and so it's not just that factor going in, but I think it was that factor. We've got a more hyperactive press. We've got social media where you can see people on gurneys in China live as it's happening. And even with their shutdown. So I think all that kind of went into this.
Absolutely. And we have the example. And that's why I think that there's a mild overreaction, a slight overreaction in the language more than anything else. Because initially, when Trump put the China travel ban in, it was, oh, you're terrible, you're a xenophobe, how dare you? And then they switched from that to, you're not doing enough, this is an outrage, it's a terrible thing, all of that stuff. So I think we're
you can't win for losing.
Right, you can't win for losing because it doesn't matter what you do, you're losing. I'm hopeful that we're going to start seeing results this week, and frankly, I think we're going to get through this a lot faster than anybody believes. Anybody who has like a megaphone. I don't know what you're doing over at La Court News, but people are canceling stuff into June. I think June's going to be a booming month for this nation.
I think you're right. Again, unless we did something longer than some of these other countries, I think that's a very good point. You know, part of it is also, I was talking to a reporter and I'm like, okay, if you're talking to four scientists and five scientists, and say, how many people do you think are going to die in America? One guy says, I think up to 5,000. Another gal says, I think up to 7,000. And then the eighth scientist says, oh, I think it could lose up to 2 million. It's like, what do you think your report's going to have? And scientists say up to 2 million people could die.
Right.
I think you always kind of take that farther shot because that's what you do when you're reporting.
Right. And the statists out there, they love to impose restrictions. They love to curtail freedom. They embrace poverty. They seek to impoverish people in their actions because they're statists, they're communists, they're Marxists, you know. And so if they have the megaphone, I got to say, Cuomo over the weekend, you know, talked, he had a press conference and he talked about, he actually tried to remain fairly neutral. I think he's recognized that he has a national platform and he can make hay with this. And if he tacks more to the center, it'll be better for him, kind of thing. But he still uses this incendiary language that's frightening people. And it's so funny because the press goes after Trump for frightening people with hope. How dare you? It's actually kind of funny. There are memes about it now. How dare you not give people hope? And then he gives people hope. How dare you give them false hope? Like, it's so stupid.
Yeah. Well, I think that one reporter, he finally jumped down his throat. It was like, that's exactly what that guy was doing. He was starting off saying, you know, you said that the drug might work. And, oh, you're giving people false hope. And then he turned it around and said, you know, what would you tell the people who are scared in their homes? And that's when the president, a couple of days ago, he finally jammed it down his throat.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Like, stop it.
What would you tell them? I love what he said. He said, I would tell them, you're a very bad reporter. I just love that. Truth bomb.
A couple of the politicians are being, you know, like I watched the whole press conference yesterday with Trump, and then I trash anybody. And we got Gavin Newsom here in California being nice to him. So it's kind of nice to see that, okay, they're putting some of this pettiness aside and some of the typical elbows and headbutts, just knowing that this is kind of more important for people. So that's actually been one of the small nice things about this whole virus from my point of view.
You understand they're just faking it. They're trying to make hay. So Ilhan Omar praised President Trump, which was like, say what? And then she came out and said, we need to offer assistance to Iran. Oh, that's what that was about. So that is, it's just about, you know, I'm sorry, I'm too cynical. So Ken LaCourte, where can we tell people to go find you and your cleverness?
You know, it's LaCourte News, it's spelled LaCourteNEWS. So, and we're, you know, we do news of day. We do a lot of look at the Silicon Valley censorship. Someday we'll talk about that again, because I think that's the next hill that conservatives either have to take or die on.
Silicon Valley censorship. Okay. We will do that.
The whole Facebook. Hey, it was terrific. Thank you for this. And I hope we get to do this again.
Yes. Thanks so much. LaCourteNews.com. All right, everybody. That was awesome. He's a very clever guy. And so go to lacourtnews.com and check it out immediately, if not sooner, because this show is almost coming to an end. What was the other thing? I wanted to talk to you about herd immunity. I'm going to have to put that off until tomorrow, I think. But there's a great op-ed on this. Herd immunity, so I don't leave you completely empty-handed, is this idea that a contagion comes into a population. There are people who are already immune. There are people who can develop immunity very quickly. And then there are people who succumb and survive and develop immunity. And then there are the people who succumb. And so at some point you go, well, how many people is it worth hurting millions of people to save 5,000 people? Probably not. Is it worth tanking the entire economy to save 5,000 lives? Probably not. But is it worth tanking the entire economy to save 2 million lives or 1 million lives? Then yes. And so the idea is, where do we sort of bow out and allow herd immunity to sort of rule the day? So we'll talk about that tomorrow. Please tune in at my YouTube page on YouTube for Sam Sorbo for my homeschooling informational videos and stuff. They're fun. We tell stories and stuff. I answer questions. Also, samsorbo.com for books and everything else. And sign up for the newsletter. Thanks so much for listening. Now go have a great rest of your day.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.